Hey everybody, welcome back to another episode of the Barely Backcountry Podcast. Today's guest is Adam Grinda. I have a really good conversation with him about all things going on up there in Alaska. But before we get into that, make sure you guys give the podcast a like, a follow, a share, all those good things. If you guys want to check out the podcast on social media, it's barely_backcountry_podcast. And then my personal is c.dillashaw. But without any further ado, I'll get you guys into this podcast with Adam. All right, guys, welcome back to another episode of the Barely Backcountry Podcast. I'm your host, Caleb Dillashaw, and today we got Adam Grinda on from way up there in Alaska. So how you doing, Adam?
I'm good, man. Thanks for having me. Sorry, I've been so tough to track down.
No problem at all, man. But so real quick, just kind of introduce yourself, tell people a little bit about what you do, and then we can get into some of the more finer details on things.
Oh, man. Well, I don't really have a career or job per se anymore. I've always been started as a fishing guide up here in Alaska. I'm originally from Idaho, so I was just working up here in the summers. And then that kind of transitioned into being a pilot and bush pilot, I guess, if you will, even though I don't really like that term. And I've done professional flying as a job for, man, like 12, 13 years. And I just quit that. I was flying for the federal government for 5 years, and I quit that about July 4th last year. So I've kind of just been a freelance entrepreneur doing a bunch of different stuff, trying to make it work.
Awesome, man. So before we get into kind of what you're doing now, what was your like upbringing? Were you into hunting and the outdoors, you know, as a kid, or did you kind of get into that as an adult, or where did that start?
Yeah, my dad took me deer hunting the first time I was like three, and his hunting buddy had bailed on him, and my mom said, just take him, and I think we were just like watching a clear cut in North Idaho or something. They shot a deer, and I was just fascinated by the whole thing, and I was so excited to get home and tell my mom we got a Christmas tree, and it wasn't a Christmas tree, it was a deer, and we actually killed something, and I was just like, man, I was fully immersed. If it had a pulse, I wanted to kill it, and yeah, that was just turned into deer hunting. And then we traveled to Southern Idaho to go mule deer hunting. My dad was never big into elk. We kind of put elk on this pedestal, like, oh man, those are the really, really good hunters. And elk hunting is just daunting because they're big and stuff like that. My dad was just him. And then I did a ton of small game with my dad. He wanted to give me a ton of opportunity and stuff like that. And so we went all the time. And I just had a huge passion for it. Got out of school. Went to college, started partying a lot, drinking my face off. It's hard to like get up and go elk hunting at 2:30 in the morning when you're closing down a bar.
Usually.
And then, met my wife, quit drinking, started hanging out with her family, the Stuck in the Rut people, kind of married into that clan, and kind of lit a fire under my ass and really started getting after it a lot more and started killing a lot more.
Nice, nice. So you grew up in Idaho?
Yeah, I was born and raised in Post Falls up in the northern part.
Gotcha, gotcha. So what were like some of like your first hunts where you were the one with the tag? When did you get to go out and do that for yourself?
Well, Idaho, you can't hunt until you're 12 for big game. And so I did a lot of small game hunting. I think when you were like 10, you could small game hunt. And the year I turned 12, they actually reduced the big game hunting age to 10. So that kind of sucked. But yeah, I was shooting does. I mean, I just kind of wanted to get kills under my belt or get reps in, you know, and just kill stuff. A lot of pheasants, a lot of coyotes, and then I had my own boat. So in between like summers of high school and stuff, I was always doing something outdoors, you know.
Gotcha. Nice. Nice, nice, nice. So growing up, were you guys doing a lot of like rifle type hunting, or were you into the archery hunting, or what was it?
No, you guys? My dad was a gun hunter. Just hard because he grew up in Colorado. And so hunting Colorado, you know, you can glass and see a lot more. Northern Idaho, everyone's like, oh, it's so beautiful. And I'm like, yeah, it's great, but there's just trees everywhere. So you can't really glass anything.
Yeah.
So unless you're a little above timberline or some south facing rocky areas, or clear cuts, that's the only place you're going to see game where they're going to be feeding. So mostly rifle stuff. I did shoot my once in a lifetime moose in Idaho when I was 12.
Your once in a lifetime Idaho moose tag when you were 12?
Yeah, I think I missed like 40 days of seventh grade or something. My dad was a sailor. like a salesman for a lumber salesman for a company. And so he was like really good at talking to the school administration and just telling them like, hey, my kid needs to miss so many days this year because we have this once in a lifetime moose tag. And so, yeah, I shot a big bull. He was like 48 inches wide. He was a big moose.
That's crazy. How for long sure. do you guys usually wait to draw that tag? How long does it usually take? And you're out there drawing it at 12 years old.
Well, dude, this was year 2000. So
gotcha.
There was moose. I think the draw had been around 10 or 15 years, but it had nowhere near the hype that Shiras does now. And everyone wants to check it off for the North American 29 and stuff. So like the draws weren't that bad. And then when I was 18, I actually drew another moose tag in Idaho because you can draw a leftover. And it was up by Bonner's Ferry, ironically where my wife's from, and never even saw a bull. I was tracking a bull in the snow, but I never saw one. But yeah, it used to be a much easier tag to draw. It was like 20% draws or something. So it wasn't hard.
Dang. Yeah, that'd be nice to have today. That's for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. It's to get a Shiras is not even fathomable for most people now.
Yeah, that's crazy. So you said you went through college and all that stuff, and then once you kind of married into the family you're in now, that's when you kind of really got into the more serious about the hunting that you're doing now?
Yeah. It just kind of like, I don't know, kind of revitalized hunting and kind of like got me back focused on, instead of being a drunk and a frat boy and doing the beer nights or whatever and hitting the kegs or whatever, I was more focused on hunting now. I didn't drink anymore. And kind of wanted to impress my wife and her brothers and stuff. And they are freaking hardcore, dude. I always joke with Travis, her oldest brother, who started Stuck in the Rut, that he must be from Kenya, because that guy sees an animal and like has a tag in his pocket, like take off full sprint. And like never goes to the gym or works out or anything, just does construction all summer. But like, man, super fit. And I'm trying to keep up with these guys. That just kind of lit a fire inside me. To really kind of get after it. And yeah, I started hunting pretty hard and killing more.
Nice. Nice. At what point did you decide to move up to fairly recent or?
So Alaska started in high school for me between my junior and senior year. I was also like I said, really involved in fishing, but I'd go and fish like, you know, Hauser Lake or something with power bait for like 2 12-inch rainbows. And my dad had fished Alaska and he's like, you know, you should go up there and just work for a camp as a guide or just a camp helper. So I did. And I think I worked for free that first summer and made like $2,000 in tips. And I was catching kings. And I just thought it was so cool, dude. And like just helping the pilots like load bags into float planes. I thought it was like the coolest thing in the world. And
yeah,
came back and I told my parents, and it's still kind of true that the pilots up here, they're kind of treated like doctors, you know, because they'll fly your sick kid to the doctor, they'll bring your groceries and your mail in. They're kind of the lifeline of the bush. And my parents said, you know, they were really encouraging. They said, that's not too far away, you can still do that. Because I said, you know, in my next life I want to be a bush pilot. And they said, well, you can do that this life. And I got after it, and I had worked every summer in Alaska since then, and then I moved up here full-time 6 years ago.
Gotcha. So you started doing like the flying thing in Alaska before you moved up there then?
Oh yeah, for sure. I worked, I don't know, a couple years as just a guide. And then I knew I wanted to fly and I wanted to fly commercially. So I got all my ratings and everything in like 9 months. I hit it really hard. And then I got up here and started working for different fishing lodges, did some air taxi work, some flight air tours, and then kind of got back into the high-end fishing lodge stuff where they have multiple different airplanes on floats and then you're flying the guides and the fishermen out all summer. And I was doing that before I moved up here full-time to take a job at the feds.
Nice. How did you get into flying? Where did that start? And then what was the process like to making that a career?
I think like everyone, it's always in the back of your mind, oh, I'd like to be a pilot someday. And I've been on a couple of small planes and everyone says that. Like it would be nice, you know, just like it'd be nice to own a Lamborghini. Yeah. But once I actually got immersed in it and I saw what a need there was for it in Alaska, and it's just super cool. I mean, just to be in these bush planes, the Havilland Beaver, and being on floats and the nasty weather and everything like that. Like, you're talking the real deal, old school dudes that I learned from. And I was like, I want to be that guy. Because we all grew up reading like Outdoor Life magazines and Field and Stream. And like, I was looking at the pictures of the Super Cubs and the Beavers flying moose tracks out. I'm like, man, this could be me. If I play my cards right and I do everything right and I learn to fly these and not kill myself, I might be able to do what those magazines are showing, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you see those pictures are iconic when you think of Alaska, you know, like you said, the Super Cubs with the caribou racks strapped to the wings and all that stuff. Those, when you think of Alaska hunting, those are the first images that come to mind for most people.
So. I know. And I say it now, and this isn't to be cocky, but like, I flew out four moose in 10 days last year, you know, like that's just Tuesday now to me. And so like, it took a lot of hard work and a ton of money, and I had to wreck some airplanes and bend some metal. Blood, sweat, and tears, but now it's like I'm finally living the dream that I always wanted to. So it's pretty cool to see it come full circle like that.
Definitely. What is like the pipeline as far as like, or the path you have to go down to making that a career, as far as like the schooling you do and then getting that to be your actual job, you know, getting in with making your own business or getting in with a business that's already established? How would somebody go about doing that?
So it's difficult because there's a lot of money up front. To be able to get a pilot, I mean, to get a pilot's license, maybe like 10, 15 grand, a couple months of your life, really dedicate yourself. It's not that hard. Like if you can pass high school, you can pass and get a pilot's license. And then you got to choose, are you going to go and just be a pilot and get an airplane and just fly privately? Or do you want to fly commercially? If you want to fly commercially, you need to get an instrument rating and then a commercial license on top of that. And that takes a minimum of 250 hours for the commercial. And that just allows you to have a license where you can fly people and get paid for it. And the problem with that at 250, you really don't, you know, just enough to kill yourself and maybe a few other people in the airplane, but you don't have enough to really be good. And so you have to hit the 500 hour mark, and 500 hours is a lot of flight time. And then you're hireable by an air taxi, and the insurance minimums kind of go down and different things like that. Once you hit 1,000, you've pretty much written your ticket. The first 1,000 hours is really hard. After that, like you pretty much got it.
Gotcha. So are most guys that are doing like the Alaskan bush pilot thing, like, are they doing it under their own business, or they're like big corporations up there that these guys are flying under, or what's it like up there?
No, so there's a lot of like, where I live in Southwest Alaska, I live in King Salmon. It's a really big hub for like the commercial fishing side, which doesn't have any flying really. But the sport fishing side, the high-end fishing lodges have Beavers, 206, 185s, all on floats usually. And that's a lot of taking people out and moving camps and setting boats up all summer. And so that's a big thing. There's an air taxi, which is exactly what it sounds like. It's just a airplane taxi cab service. And you say, hey, my name's Caleb. I want to go here. My money's green and take me. And if it's safe and the weather's good, they're going to take you. There's some transporter companies that like do specific hunting drop-offs and whatnot. Similar to an air taxi, but they kind of sell it as a package deal and a hunt. There's hunting outfitters. There's pilots that fly just for outfitters. So on the positive side of all the money it takes to get into the business and all of the issues you have to go through and learn how to, you know, just because you have a license, you don't know how to fly. You know, you still have to learn how to not kill yourself and manipulate the controls of an airplane and actually get it on the ground and be able to take off of the load and make those decisions quickly. But there is a huge need for people doing the kind of flying I'm doing up here, but no one wants to do it. Everyone wants to go to the majors, get the 1,000 hours, you know, get some turbine time, get 1,500 hours, and then go fly for Horizon or Alaska Airlines and be a pavement pounder.
Gotcha. So what type of planes are you guys flying up there? Obviously, the Super Cub is probably the most known one. So kind of explain what that is and then just like what the plane types are that you're seeing from these Alaska-type flights.
Yeah, so the Super Cub is great. It can land short. It can fly slow and everything. But for working for a company, they suck. Like I've flown commercially and Cubs and everything. And everyone's like, oh, do you like the Cub? And I said, no, I hate it, because when I'm working and moving people and gear, I need to, it's kind of like framing a house. You want to see a lot of production at the end of the day. I want to move thousands of pounds of gear and people to multiple different locations throughout the day. And to do that in a Cub, it takes multiple trips, and they're the slowest plane there is. A 185 can seat a pilot plus three people and carry about 800 to 1,000 pounds, depending on certain things and how much fuel you bring. And they go pretty fast. And then the big people mover and gear haulers, the Havilland Beaver, and those are can bring about 12, 13, maybe 1,400 pounds, and they'll seat a pilot plus six. So like two guys and a bunch of stuff, or four guys in a light camp, can go in on a Beaver. And they're really good at getting out of short places and doing heavy loads. And they're built in the 50s, man. They're the iconic bush plane of Alaska.
Gotcha. Gotcha. What's kind of like the like range on those? Like how far in are you able to take guys before like you just can't go any further because you'll run out of fuel?
We got enough gas to get there and then get back. So a Beaver can do about 3.5 hours. They have fuel tanks in the wingtips, actually. You can do a little more. Guys will bring some jerry cans and the floats and fill up and different things. But, you know, about 100, 150 miles and stuff like that. That's a pretty big range from some kind of base. Because as soon as you leave whatever base you're at, you're pretty much in the bush, you know, as soon as you're outside of town. So you don't need to go super far. And that's catch 22. The more fuel you have, the less weight and people and gear you can have, because that kind of takes away from the load.
Gotcha. Gotcha. When you're landing these planes out there, I'm assuming it's just kind of you're finding your landing strip. You guys don't have like pre-made landing strips out there for you, or once you get back in there, or?
Yeah. I mean, depends on what you're doing. If you're most of the country we're in down here is on floats, it's a lot of water.
Okay.
And so fuel planes, you just got to make sure it's deep enough, which is like up to your waist in the Beaver, and, you know, long enough to get in and land, and then long enough to get that load of moose meat out before you hit the brush in the end of that pond or river or whatnot. But there's a lot of strips and different things like that that guys use, but I try to stay away from airstrips, because that's where people go, you know, and I'm trying to separate myself from people and get away from others.
Yeah, that makes sense for sure. Well, you mentioned earlier that you had a few wrecks as you were learning. Do you have any good stories of some plane wrecks that you'd share with us?
Oh, man, yeah. There's a really good book, too. It's called The Killing Zone, and it's talking about pilots, you know, and you're 250 hours to 500 hours, and you think you are a Top Gun Maverick, dude. You think you're dragging on the ground, and you are really badass. And that's why I hate the term bush pilot, because everyone – and this is probably going to hurt some feelers — everyone thinks they're Billy Badass Bush Pilot. You know, go to Instagram and type in Bush Pilot, and there is Bush Pilot 123, Bush Pilot 1234. Everyone puts it as their handle because they want to be Mr. Bush Pilot. And, you know, I had just got done watching YouTube. I thought I was a bush pilot. I was flying for a guide. He was actually had a Cub. He wanted me to fly and do some guiding for him for fishing and maybe some hunts down the road. And I took it up the Kinnick River right outside of Anchorage, which is like a huge playground of giant gravel bars. Everyone goes up there. And I was just hot rodded, dude. I was doing stuff in that Cub that I wouldn't even do with my Cub now. And I have 6,500 hours, right? I remember taking off one time and skimming across the water and doing stuff. And one landing, I remember, I was coming in on a gravel bar, and I flew over a couple hundred feet. I'm like, yeah, looks good. 300 feet long. This airplane's doing anything I want it to do. And I'm feeling good, right? Yeah. So I go in, and I land kind of on this lighter colored pea gravel, and it's got 31-inch bushels. Pretty good. It was kind of a beater Cub, like $50,000 Cub. But it was strong, performed well. Well, I didn't see this gravel bar. It kind of had some erosion, kind of had some whoops in it, like you'd see on motocross. And so I'm landing, and I'm kind of in no man's land, going like 20 to 25 miles an hour. So I'm not flying, but I'm not close to stopping yet either when I hit this little jump. And I'm going, and it kicks me up like 4 feet in the air. And I'm like, oh, and I had a left crosswind coming from the left about 15 knots. And I should have turned into the wind and gone full power. If it would have happened to me now, I just would have dumped the flap off the wings, and it would plant the airplane on the ground and pull the stick back, and it would have probably been fine, you know. Yeah. but I didn't. So I went full power because everything you're taught in flight training, if it's not looking right, go around, which means add the gas, try again. And so now I'm taking off again, but I turn to the right. And so I turn downwind. And when you turn downwind, the wind, kind of like a duck, it pushes the ducks down. Okay. If you're ever in waterfowl circle and stuff. And so now the wind's pushing me down to the ground. So I pull the stick back because I'm coming into the trees. And I pull the stick back more. I'm not coordinated. I'm probably in a hard slip. And so the airplane's like ready to stall. But if you're not coordinated and you're all crooked with the rudder, it'll actually spin. And so the whole thing snapped over. It spun from like 25 feet up, full power, basically inverted, corkscrewed into the ground, augered into the ground. I flipped over and totally crashed the thing. Totally wrecked it and should have killed myself. The whole top deck of the airplane crushed in 2 feet. I'm a big dude at 6'2". On my knee, I climbed out and thought my life was over. I'm never going to fly again. And that was a big wake-up call for me that I suck and I am not very good and I need to slow my roll.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that could be said for a lot of things. Like for a little bit, I was getting into – like scuba diving stuff. I went and got just the most basic certification. But like you said, you know enough just to get out there and kill yourself if you really, really get overconfident with it.
Oh, yes. That will kill you. Airplanes, anything will kill you if you don't respect your limits, respect Mother Nature. And mine was just plain physics. And I had an evaluator where I wanted to land well enough. And when I did come into an issue, I didn't apply the appropriate corrective technique. And I did the exact opposite wrong thing. And I told the airplane, hey, I want you to spin and I want you to stall violently. And the airplane listened and it did exactly what I told it to do.
Yeah.
And that, my friend, is called pilot error.
At a pretty remote airstrip, like were you just kind of out in the middle of nowhere by yourself at that point or?
No, I mean, they salvaged the airplane with four-wheelers, I think low water and trailers and stuff. Okay. It was a big deal. The guy sued me and everything. And I was was flying like his airplane to like build time and everything and working under his business to do stuff. But he had sued me and he never told me the airplane wasn't insured. And we got in this big pissing match. We ended up settling out of court, but it really sucked. And it wasn't good for anyone. And I still run into that guy from time to time and he just mean mugs me. But, you know, it is what it is. And it sucked. I wish it wouldn't have happened, but you know.
Yeah, but I mean at the end of the day it was a learning experience. You walked away from it and now you have that knowledge going forward. So
yeah, and I share that story to help other people, to hopefully keep them if they have questions about technique or off airport flying or different things or how to evaluate a runway, please, I tell people, please reach out and ask me because I would way rather share my screw ups than you do something dumb like wreck an airplane or break your neck.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. How big of a deal is the weather up in Alaska when it comes to flying? Does that prevent you guys from flying quite often? Or because you hear that a lot. Like I've known some guys that have gone up to Alaska to do a caribou hunt and, you know, they end up there being stuck up there for an extra 6 days because of weather. So.
Yeah, that's how you die, man. Two things will kill you when you have this mode of I am going to go. Caleb and I are getting out of the field and we're flying back to Anchorage Tuesday. If you have that mentality, we are going to Anchorage Tuesday to get a pizza and a beer, you're going to kill yourself. And if you have the notion of we need to be here at this day, and the biggest thing, and I tell my kids, is don't fly into the clouds. And my six-year-old little daughter knows this. The clouds is where those mountains hide. And if you fly through the clouds, you're going to hit the mountains eventually, and that's what kills you.
Gotcha. When that happens, like when guys get kind of just stuck up there on a hunt because of weather, how many days are they typically stuck up there? Like what's kind of your average weather timeline?
Man, my buddy Tyler Frill has a really good podcast called Tundra Talk. And I was him. He got stuck on a sheep hunt. And I remember their story. It was getting pretty bad. Like they were about to shoot a bear, possibly to eat it and to like take a sleeping pad and make a raft and float out and shoot some ducks with a rifle. Like it was getting past day four and you can only bring so much food on an airplane because you're limited to weight. Like you can't just bring 15 days of extra food. So yeah, it can get pretty bad.
Yeah. Crazy. Yeah. That's when you hope you actually had a successful hunt and got some camp meat laying around.
You know, that's what a lot of people I see, they really start to panic and fail when things aren't working out, that you really get you get a sense of who your hunting partner really is. Yeah. And guys start to lose it mentally. And that's, you know, that'll kill you faster than anything. When you lose your mental toughness like that, you're a pretty weak individual at that point. And that's when you really just have to stay strong and be like, look, the pilots know we're here. They're not going to just leave you out there to die. And when the weather's good, the pilots will come get you. The worst thing you can do is bug those guys, because then they're not going to come get you first. If you just say, hey, we're sitting here, this is our situation, this is the weather, we are packed, ready to go, and please update us of any changes. That's what pilots want. They don't want you to sit there and blow them up, because trust me, from I've been on both sides of it, and just respect the pilots. They'll respect you. And when the weather's good, they're going to come get you. And it may be perfect where you're at, and you go 10 miles around the corner, and it's blowing 60 inches to the ground, and they can't pick you up.
Yeah. Yeah, I hadn't even thought of that, that weather might be bad in between you guys, not necessarily where you're at.
Absolutely. And they'll try and make a run, and they can't get there, and they'll turn around because – you know, they're following my rules of, hey, I'm going through the mountain pass and it's choked full of clouds. Like, I'm not going in there because I got a wife and kids at home, and I'm turning around. And when that mountain pass is clear, I'll squeak through and pick you up.
Yeah.
So yeah,
that makes sense. Have you had any situations personally or heard of anywhere like the guys that are kind of stuck out there start to kind of like lose it mentally and you run into issues with that? Or
I had some guys when I worked for the Park Service, and I would consider them both acquaintances, and they were good. They were actually in a cabin over on the coast, and they had like a whole tote, you know, like a whole 40-gallon tote of Mountain House and freeze-dried food and propane, and it was 9 days before I could go pick them up. And a lot of that wasn't weather. Like, the first 4 days was weather, and then we had a broken cylinder bolt on the Beaver, and so we're waiting on the Beaver to get fixed to go pick them up, and it was our only float plane, so it was just kind of Pandora's box. And they weren't panicking, but the dispatch side of that was putting a lot of pressure on me. And I'm not that old. I'm only 33, but I've done this enough. And I just told him, I said, look here, guys, you don't know anything about airplanes. I do. I have thousands of hours of not killing people. And today is not the day we're going to start. The weather sucks. I'm not going. When it's good, I'll go there. Now shut it. And I walked out. So
there you go.
I pretty much just told him how it is, because people who don't know anything about aviation, who aren't pilots, really try and tell you how to do the job. And pilots don't really like that. I'm not trying to sound cocky. I'm just like, look, I'm the professional. You guys hired me to do the job. It's not safe. And so when it is, we'll go get them.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's the way it needs to be done. I think most professions could probably say the same thing about that. Maybe not to the extent you guys have it, but I think that goes for most professions out there.
Yeah, absolutely. I've always been that way. I'm not going to tell the scuba diver or the fishing guide or the welder how to do their job, because they can do their job better than I know how to do their job.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So I see up there in Alaska, you're doing a lot of like trapping and then obviously hunting up in Alaska. So kind of tell me what you guys are doing up there as far as like your own like personal recreation type stuff.
So the biggest notion is I'm a guide. I'm not a guide. I would probably be really good, except I have this really bad itch. Like, I always want to pull the trigger. And being a hunting guide, I think I did it for the fishing. I think I would lose the love of the hunting. I'm not willing to risk that. So now I just take my buddies and we go for free. But it's really cool. My wife and I kind of have this saying, and it's kind of formulated after, like, living here 5 years. Last spring was, like, kind of a five-year anniversary. With this Super Cub, it just opens up so many doors to have an airplane and to have the ability to just go flying whenever you want. There's a lot of sacrifice and everything, and obviously a lot of time training to get my skill set where it needs to be. But we have pretty much like one time world-class adventures like every month, you know? And just for a rundown, like, it's springtime, we'll go down and do beachcombing down the peninsula, which there's those little Japanese glass balls that are like 4 to 5 inches around. And they had like, I don't know, old Chinese, Japanese guys like drinking sake, smoking cigarettes on the boats, blowing these glass balls before styrofoam and plastic were around to like float the nets. And so we'd go find those on the beach, land and pick them up. And it's kind of like a grown-up treasure hunt. And they're pretty cool.
That's cool, man.
you'll find dead walrus washed up on the beach, and we can cut their heads off, and so you can legally obtain ivory. That's pretty cool. Super stinky. That's in the spring. I'll pick up a few sheds like that. Just moose and caribou kind of dinking around. It's been pretty late for spring. We had a lot of snow, and so bears are still kind of rolling out, but I got like a 3 or 4 day bear hunt planned with a buddy for brown bears the end of spring, or end of May, excuse me. June, I'll do some black bear hunting with some kids, and we'll roll right into some king salmon fishing, some fly out trout fishing with my kids and salmon. We do a lot of subsistence net in the summer where we catch sockeyes or reds, and we, I don't know, put up like 200 to 300 pounds of fish every summer because we eat that throughout the year because I got 5 kids. August, we pretty much start hunting caribou and sheep. Caribou's August 1st, and then 10th. So we're like a month or 6 weeks ahead of the lower 48 as far as hunting season. And we'll ride into there. September is crammed full of moose. October is bear. November gets kind of slow, so I usually go to lower 48, hunt outside. And then December, I'm kind of prepping for trapping, and then I'll trap January, February, March, and just kind of start all over, dude. There's always something to do.
Yeah. So you just kind of finished up your trapping season then, right?
Yeah, I hit it pretty hard this year. We just had a ton of snow, so it was really good because you go on skis, which are basically essentially two big snowboards. You don't have any brakes or anything, but the airplane can float on a lot of powder, and you don't have any brakes. But with a lot of snow, you're able to access a lot of country and set a lot of gear. So I hit it pretty hard for wolverine and wolves.
Gotcha. What kind of, are those the traps you guys are using up there? Are you allowed to use like the like kill traps, or does it have to be a live trap, or what is that like?
Alaska's pretty liberal when it comes to trapping and stuff like that. So I want something, since I don't know when I'm going to be able to check my traps, and Alaska's great that we don't have any trap check laws, because honestly, that would probably kill people if you were trying to be law abiding. Yeah. You had to go out and it was negative 50 that day. Bad things can happen. I try and check once a week every 10 days, but I either want a snare that's a dispatch snare to kill a wolf, or I want like a 330 conibear that's going to kill a wolverine, because I'm not going to risk the animal sitting out there for possibly longer than a week to 10 days if the weather sucks or anything happens and I can't get out there. So I want to be as humane as possible. So those are the kind of two I use, because everything's done with an airplane.
Gotcha. Gotcha. And is the trapping kind of like a source of income for you? Or are you doing that to, you know, flesh out the hides and tan them and all that stuff? Is that a source of income, or?
I mean, it is, but I spent 10 grand on gas. So that's a lot of fur you got to sell. My thought was this, Caleb, like I have been a trapper for a long time, and I kind of did coyotes here and there in Idaho. You're most of the time you're unsuccessful, and it's a lot of disappointment. And I said, okay, I'm going to go balls to the wall, and I'm going to put out so much gear, and I'm going to invest so much money that the only way to make it work is to do that. And I'm going to catch fur. I'm probably going to lose money, but I'm going to catch a lot of fur. And so that was my goal, is put out tons of gear. I set a pretty big line. Like, for instance, most trappers will trap one drainage, right, with a snow machine. I'm trapping like 13 different drainages. So when I pull 12 wolverine, that's one out of each drainage. That's not really over trapping, where one guy gets 2 wolverine a season, he's ecstatic. I'm just running a bunch of country, you know.
Gotcha.
And setting a lot of gear because I want to catch fur. And then there is a freaking pile of work behind putting up fur. I mean, it is so labor intensive, but like I said, beginning, I don't drink. So like, it's dark up here all winter. What am I going to do?
Yeah. Yeah. No, it sounds, I mean, like I said, it sounds like a ton of work, but it does sound like some fun too. And, you know, sounds like you're having some good success. So is there a pretty big market for the fur up there, or are you shipping it to the lower 48 or other countries, or?
No, the fur market sucks. Guys go to auction and stuff nowadays. There's no money in like the fur market. I know a lot of guys held on to the fur this year because they don't want to take it to like Alaska's Fur Rondi or anything like that. I sell all my stuff off Instagram, and all my stuff's put up taxidermy prep. So like the ears are turned, the lips are split, completely fleshed out, salted. I sell everything dry, ready to go. And I used to tan some stuff and send it to Moyles, but then I'd get taxidermists like, hey, I want to buy one for a showcase item, but I do my own tanning. And so then I just started selling stuff dry, and I sell it for a lot of money. And I have people like try and offer me, like, I'll sell Wolverine for like $800. And he goes, oh, what about 600? And I said, look here, pal, I'm not a garage sale, so you can take a hike. And if you want a Wolverine, I just ask him, how many guys do you know that have four Wolverine you can pick from and send you pictures and videos?
Yeah.
Probably not a lot, you know?
Yeah, I can bet if they're not paying to willing to pay $800, you can make a phone call in 30 seconds and find somebody that is.
Well, a lot of my stuff sells even before, because I have like client lists, repeat clients and taxidermists and stuff that just want stuff. And, you know, I get that's a lot of money and everything, but there's people out there with money and I have to spend. I mean, every time I go check traps is like $400 just in fuel.
Yeah.
You know, so I need to be catching fur. And then, I mean, a wolf probably has 4 to 5 hours of labor, and a Wolverine's probably about 2.5 to 3. You know, so then you got to figure out an hourly rate and everything like that. And I might be breaking even by the time it's all said and done, but yeah, it sure is fun though, dude. It's cool to be successful. It's cool to catch multiple Wolverine. It's cool to outsmart wolves. And it kind of makes you feel like one of those mountain men, you know, because you're putting up fur.
For sure. I can imagine. Along with the fur, what is the deal with why is that such a – why do people want them? What even is it? Let's start with that.
Bastard. I can't believe you went there.
I know.
So I didn't even know – I didn't even know wolves had – it's called a baculum. Like bears have a penis bone. Raccoons do. Wolverines, wolves, fox, coyotes. We got a bunch of wolves. We trapped like 3 or 4, and we got them back. We had some buddies down here, so everyone grabbed a wolf. We all skinned them. One of my friends, like, was very liberal and like, all the fat and muscle he left on. And so we rolled this wolf up, put it in the freezer, and I think we were flying the next day to go pull some traps or something. And then, like, a couple weeks later, I pulled this wolf out of the freezer. I'll hang it up. You know, I got to pull the feet out and flesh everything. And I was fleshing it, and I, like, hit something hard on the beam, and I, like, grabbed it. I'm like, this thing, I didn't know this. I know bears had them, but I was never like into dick bones, right? And I grabbed this thing and I cut it off. And there's something hard in here. This is weird. And so then I like fleshed this thing out, and it's like 5 1/4 inches long. This thing's got a dick bone. And so, like, totally is a joke, right? It was just like, I didn't even ask my wife, because she just like rolled her eyes and told me I'm a sick bastard. But I didn't tell her, and I just put this on my Instagram. I said, I'm going to take bids on this super awesome wolf dick bone for the next 24 hours. And it bid up to $105. I was like, are you kidding me, dude? And so, yeah, like the saying used to be $20. It's not gay. $20 is $20. And I was just like, I started telling people, I'm like, I was selling dick bones for $100. I'm like, dude, $100 is $100. You need a dick? I'm going to get you a dick. I got a whole stack of wolf bodies out back. If you need me to go back there and whack one of these dicks off, I will. And, dude, it just kind of took off. And I don't know if the whole Instagram following is a bunch of perverts, but guys were doing it. And I was bartering, like, hey, if you buy a hide to skull, I'll throw the dick bone in for free. And so, yeah, it just kind of manifested. A couple companies I work with, like a beard company, Effect Beard Care, I'll plug that in there. And Backpack Logistics, my buddy Dustin's food company, like a code dickbone is actually like one of my discount codes. So guys are reaching out to me like, hey, can I use dickbone as your code? I'd love to have it for my company. And so I guess I'm getting a tramp stamp that says dickbone.
There you go. I think you have to at this point.
But it's kind of my handle on the radio, you know, when people hear me flying around. Like, hey, dickbone, is that you? How's the weather up there?
What are people using it for? Like, why do they want it? Or is it just they want it for the joke, kind of?
It's like a gag gift, I think. Maybe like bachelorette. I don't freaking know, dude. One thing was like the first guy that bought it was like, I just want to contribute to the Avgas fund for killing all the wolves. I appreciate that. And then other guys like collect them. I think some guys use them as like a martini stir stick, you know, and they have a drink at your house. Oh, here, stir your drink with this. And then you get to like tell your buddies like, guess what that is? That's a dick bone from Adam Grenda. I don't know, dude. I don't get it. But yeah, it kind of turned into something. And I guess I was known for like flying super cubs in the nasty places and killing huge moose. But now I'm kind of known as like the dick bone guy. So I guess I'm just going to roll with it.
Yeah. You just got to embrace it at that point, I think.
But I mean, when you think about it, so you can sell a Wolverine for, you know, $600 to $800, depending on the quality of hide, sometimes more if it's a big mounter. I get $250 for a skull and like $50 for a dick bone. I mean, it starts adding up.
Yeah.
And you add up all these different dicks. I mean, you could be getting some serious money, you know?
For sure. Is it pretty consistent? Like people are wanting those, or is it just kind of like an every once in a while type thing?
I just sold my last one the other day. So you tell me. I mean, yeah. There you go.
Yeah, yeah. All sold out of dick bones. I guess that there must be a demand for it.
Yeah, I don't know, dude. It's totally weird, and it just kind of like happened. And I like to have a pretty good sense of humor. And I tell people all the time, like, you know, I'll run my mouth on social media this, and I tell people, don't. It's not a dick bone. Don't take it so hard. Like, Instagram is just like fake reality. You know, I try and be as real as I can on there, but. You know, I don't know why it manifested into this or whatever, but I guess I'm just going to roll with it. It's funny, at least.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. Well, getting off of that, let's talk about what you got coming up for the rest of the year. So draw applications are coming out, or draw results are starting to come out for a lot of states. You know, we'll be getting into scouting season, then hunting season in the fall. Obviously, most of your stuff is going to be in Alaska, but what else you got planned for the rest of the year for you?
Yeah, I don't plan on hunting lower 48 a lot. This year, I did a lot last year. I shot a big bull in Montana with my bow. I shot a deer in Kansas, and then I shot a really big bighorn in Idaho. And I saw a lot of people, and people is not something you're used to seeing in Alaska. If we're seeing people at the Super Cub, I'll just leave and go somewhere other people can't go, or just to a different area. Mm-hmm. So I told myself I wasn't going to hunt lower 48 this year, but I think I'm planning an Idaho elk hunt. I'll probably draw Kansas again, and I might have a lead on an Oryx hunt. So that's pretty cool. And then all the Alaska stuff. In Alaska, there's not enough time for the amount of tags you can fill here. It's just insane what you can actually kill as a resident.
As an Alaska resident, like what tags, like is everything kind of over the counter for you guys, or is it still draw stuff? Like when you're talking like the brown bears and the doll sheep and moose and all that stuff.
Yeah, there's draws for all that. I put in for like the one, I don't draw for brown bears. I live on the Alaska Peninsula. It's over the counter here. But I put in for the good sheep tags. But I mean, with a $94 hunt fish trap license in Alaska, you can shoot, man, if I had to add it up, you can shoot 2 goats, I think 5 or 6 deer, one bull moose, a cow moose in some areas, 2 to 5 brown or grizzly bears, depending on what unit, unlimited black bears in some units. The muskox is a draw, a bison's a draw. You can shoot 10 wolves per day. I mean, it's crazy the amount of stuff you can actually hunt. And all those are pretty much come with your hunting license. Like you don't buy a license and then go buy a tag or a permit. They just, I print them off of my computer at home. You just get them for free.
That's awesome.
Yeah. It's pretty nuts. Like there's always something to be hunting up here. It just, like I said before, it really revolves around the weather, what you're allowed to do.
Yeah. So what, from what you're saying now, it sounds like being an Alaska resident is all like, you know, a bunch of sunshine and flowers and a whole bunch of good stuff. What's the bad part? I'm assuming weather is a pretty rough thing up there.
Yeah, I mean, I try to be optimistic. You know, a lot of people get pissy in the winter and you get seasonal depression. You have to leave. Like we joke and say we have to go get vitamin D. So I'll go to Cabo for a couple weeks. I'll go to Hawaii or whatever. Different things like that. But you have to go and like escape a little bit in December or January when it's pretty dark. It's dark, cold. It can be pretty miserable. The weather sucks. You can't get Amazon 2-day shipping. A lot of stuff won't. Like I tried to buy a couple air filters for the Cub the other day. It was $70 in air filters and $318 to ship them. Obviously, I didn't buy those. Just stuff like that where we live. You can't get hazmat stuff. I live off the road system for Southwest Anchorage, 300 miles. You can fly it in or barge it in, but that's it. There's no road to us. So it's catch 22, like you don't have the extracurricular activities like, you know, ballet and karate and wrestling, all that stuff year round for your kids. But then your kids aren't immersed in a big city with a bunch of other asshole kids, you know, and a bunch of bad influence. And so There's good and there's bad with it. My biggest thing is I live in a really, really remote place. I'm married to a freaking bombshell of a girl who makes way more money than I do selling dick bones, and she loves it. She's like a hermit. And when I met my wife, Tana, she was in school to be an air traffic controller, and they were going to send her to, like, go work for FAA Center in Oklahoma and sit in a dark room with a bunch of gamers. And I'm like, hey, that sounds pretty lame. Do you want to go work at a fishing lodge on the Quijack and fly out in float planes all summer and catch fish? And she's like, sure. So, yeah, hooked her in, and she loves living here. She loves all the experiences we get to do, and she likes having her own personal pilot. It makes it pretty easy for her to shoot moose in bad places and just say, oh, I shot one over here. Come figure out where to land and pick it up. Thanks.
Nice. Like, if you want to go out and do something, or you got to go into town to do something, you essentially have to fly there or take a boat.
Yeah, you just, I mean, we live in King Salmon. There's 10,000 foot runway. It's an old Air Force base. There's every day of the year, there's at least one Alaska Airlines flight. Now I think there's two Alaska Airlines flights coming and going. You know, like, my wife just left for Anchorage today, and she'll come back tomorrow. So it's like a 50-minute flight to go to Anchorage. It's $700 round trip, so it's not cheap. But you have to go there for all your medical appointments and different things, and she'll get a bunch of Costco and groceries when she's there. So logistically, it's really hard to live out here, and there's not a lot to do. Like, there's one bar/restaurant. There's another bar/restaurant that's only open seasonally. We have a very limited supply of, like, hardware store or Napa. There's no Walmart. There's no place to get your freaking nails done. Like, there's nothing to do out here, except when you leave in an airplane 5 minutes outside town, you're in the middle of freaking nowhere.
Yeah.
So it's pretty sweet.
Nice. So, one, I do kind of want to, I know you guys have a full video of it, but just kind of tell people about that, that bighorn hunt that you had in Idaho. Was that last year?
Yeah. I don't know how, dude. I started using Hunting Fool for my draw apps, and I think maybe it was them that I got lucky. They were at the pretty bottom of the barrel, I guess, for choices, because they put me on the cover of April. So you're actually talking to a cover girl. So all my buddies gave me a hard time about that. Yeah, I drew a Central Idaho bighorn tag, and I just didn't have a ton of time to scout. Everyone's like, you need to devote your whole life to bighorn, this and that. I was working for the Park Service. I quit around July 4th. I was building a hangar house up here in the bush, which was a huge monumental project. And I didn't get done with that till like August 13th. And then I went straight to Idaho, did my brother-in-law's wedding. I officiated that. And then we went straight down to Central Idaho to scout. And our typical fashion is like show up a day early. We were there 2 days early. I talked to a couple guys the year before. They said, hey, the big ram was missed up in this drainage the first day of scouting. I walked in there and I heard their heads cracking, like they're smashing horns. And it took me a couple times to kind of locate them, kind of like when you hear an elk bugle. It was like you're like second guessing yourself. And then I found these two smaller rams, like, oh, those are cool. I would probably shoot those like towards the end of the hunt, you know, so at least I'm seeing a ram because they're a pretty low density animal. And then I look up the hill and I see this one, and it's like, half second, you know, it's just like, oh, dude, that thing's got it. Like, big old Roman nose, sway back, pot belly. And I've killed a couple doll rams up here, and they're pretty thin horned. Like, the bases are like 13, and the base on my rams are like 16. So, like, when they say big horn, they mean it. Like, he carries the mass all the way down. And, yeah, long story short, the biggest problem with that hunt was there was, like, one trailhead access point. And no, actually, there was a couple, I think, but like everyone was pretty much at the same trailhead. You're in the middle of freaking nowhere, and then boom, all these dudes are here. And then the day before opener, all these more guys start showing up because everyone needs like 17 glassers with them, and I only had two, right? So I'm feeling outnumbered, and it's like freaking straight Mossback. There's just like dudes with them and stuff, and I'm just like, oh, man, can't sleep. And the night before, I've been watching the sheep morning and evening. The night before, we go down there to glass this ram. And, like, strategically, these guys had went down there, like, hurry up, packed everything. Because we were trying to, like, ask them, like, hey, which direction you guys headed? Super vague. Like, oh, yeah, we're not really sure. I was like, okay. I mean, we tried to play ball, you know. And, like, asked, he's like, what are you guys thinking? What are you seeing? And they wouldn't say anything. So I'm like, okay, at this point, like, it's public land. It's going to suck. Someone's going to get their piss in their Cheerios, right? And I just hope it's not me. And we go down there, and these guys have like their tent right above this ram, like within a half mile glassing him. And the thermals are blowing down at night. I'm like, well, that's freaking stupid. I wouldn't set my tent there. But it was like right where you would walk down on this ridge to get to this glassing point. And I'm like, okay, well, guys try that in Alaska all the time. And they set like dummy tents up on runways and everything to say, hey, we're here. Don't come and land here. And I'm like, look here. I don't freaking roll that way. If I want to hunt somewhere, I'm going. And people are not. And a lot of guys get weird about that. But it's like there's very limited sheep in this area. The wolves had pulled in. And where the sheep normally were hanging out, there was no sheep. And so this is like the only ram we found. And I've watched day and night for the last 2 days. And so we wake up at, I think, I don't know, 1:50 or 2 o'clock in the morning. I don't remember what it was. We hiked 3.5 hours in the dark, formulated a plan. I was in position to kill that thing like early, like before even first light. Like we made sure to like have the world clock time and data and stuff. What exactly was sunrise so we could have it. Like you have, Alaska doesn't have shooting hours. I think it's like half hour before sunrise you can kill.
Yeah.
And so like, to the minute we were ready to go, and I was like frantically glassing. My brother-in-law Tom found him, and like the first 15 minutes, I killed him. So
that's awesome.
It was pretty stressful. I made a long shot. It was 880, but I was shooting a 1200 the day before, and I think there was like a thermal that was pushing my bullets up or something. And after the first shot, I can hold the adrenaline till the first shot, but I'm like, I'm losing on this big one because like all these emotions are coming over me. And I'm just freaking out, stressful. There's guys on the other side coming down on top of the ram. There's headlamps all over this basin. And it was just stressful. But to finally kill him and anchor him was super cool. We walked up to him, and I think he scored like 181. So Boone and Crockett ram. So had to life-size him, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
It was crazy.
Yeah. How was that pack out? Because I've been in Idaho for one hunt, and the country is rough up there. So I could imagine in sheep country, it's even more so. Like, how was that pack out?
I was a little I was going into like a little cocky. I'm like, oh, I'm from Alaska, dude. I've hunted the Brooks. I've hunted the Alaska Range. I've been in the Wrangles. Like, it's going to be no big deal. Like, central Idaho, that's big country, dude. It's big. It's gnarly. There's some impassable stuff where you get cliffed out. It's weird hunting sheep in the timber. Like I'm a pilot. I don't do very well in heights, like big shale slopes and grasses, stuff steep, but the timber makes you feel more secure because they're like in little cliff bands in the timber.
Yeah.
I think it was like, we had to drop 2000, climb up another 500, get them, cross a creek, and then carry them out like 2000, but there's like horse trails. And so that was pretty cool because Alaska traversing country on soggy tundra and blowdown and thick alder is really difficult to actually cover distance. And, you know, once you get to the top of a ridge in the lower 48, like it's pretty hard ground. There's an elk trail or a horse trail. And so we were able to move. And I'm used to like taking out a whole animal by myself. And I had two other guys to split one sheep. And so like they split the meat. I took the cape and the head and the horns and carried it out of there.
Nice. Nice. How long did that take you guys?
Oh, to get out?
Yeah.
Oh, it was – I mean, we left 10 at, I don't know, 2 in the morning. We got back at, like, 1, so it was almost a 24-hour ordeal. But, you know, we got a lot of those, you know. Where you,
yeah.
Like, but that's, like – those are the cool stories you remember. Oh, yeah. You don't remember the ones you shot off the side of the road. So,
For sure.
Those ones you really got to grind are the fun ones to remember.
For sure. As a former resident of Idaho and now a non-resident, what's your opinion on how they're doing their tag system for non-residents now for, like, over-the-counter stuff?
Oh man, I heard it's a freaking joke. To get in there and call the number and everything, it's a very convoluted system and it seems very inefficient. But I mean, that's your federal government and your state governments for you. I'm sure a private party entity could probably do a much better job. But every year when they open that up, the system crashes and stuff. I was in Kansas last year when it went down doing it and everything, and it's stressful just to try and jump in and get a tag. But yeah, Idaho's sold themselves as the opportunity. So everyone floods to Idaho, and I hope they don't go to a point system, but at some point you think they might want to, or someone might propose it because you have so many people in this playing field and only so many tags, right?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. I can't remember who it was, but I had someone on the podcast and we were talking about it, and their idea was having like almost like a hunting draw, but you would draw for basically your spot in line. So that way everybody's not rushing to the website at one time. So you draw and say you're allowed on the website from 10 a.m. to 10:30. And you know, if you get a good time, then you're going to have a lot of tags left. If not, then oh well. But that was their idea. And I thought that was pretty interesting.
Yeah, it's pretty tough. I mean, I don't really put too much, I guess, thought into it. I try to draw tags in all the Western states, you know, everything like besides Nevada or whatever. I gave up on Nevada. But, you know, the whole over-the-counter thing is like there's a lot of public, a lot of people. And it sounds bad, but if I'm going to travel and spend thousands of dollars to go and hunt outside in the lower 48, I want a premium tag. I don't just want to be like, okay, we're going to go and we're going to like see 270, 280 bulls. Or like a good bull is going to be a 300-inch elk. Like that really doesn't get me going that much when I could be up here shooting caribou, sheep, moose, brown bears, have a whole pocket full of tags. You know, it's got to be a pretty special hunt. So the whole over-the-counter thing doesn't really get me too excited, but they need to change it because yeah. I did partake of it last year and it sucked.
Yeah, for sure. Well, that makes sense, especially the situation you're in. I mean, coming down to hunt, you know, any state in the lower 48 is not a – it's not an easy task, I would imagine, calling all the way from Alaska for that, so.
No, it's a long time to travel. I mean, it's usually – pretty much everything out of Anchorage is a red eye, so I get to Anchorage, leave at 1 in the morning, and then you're jet lagged, and you got to get your guns and all your stuff down there. And then, you know, depending on where you go, usually I'll try and link up with someone or borrow a truck. You might be renting a truck and different things. It is surreal, though. When you get down there, it's like, we have a truck. Like, where I'm at, like, that's not a possibility. So there's no heater. There's no way to go get warm. So it's like, you can't get wet. If you get wet, you might die.
Yeah.
You know, if you get wet, lower 48, you just keep moving and walk to the truck and turn the heater on. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, definitely.
So a lot of differences, you know?
For sure, for sure. Last thing before we kind of wrap this up. So Alaska is kind of seen as, like, that's, like, you know, some people's once in a lifetime big adventure hunt. For guys that are in the lower 48 that want to come up there and hunt Alaska, what is your recommendation on the type of hunt they should do, how they should go about doing it? What's your opinion on that?
Man, everyone wants a moose. You can do a moose to start. You're going to want at least one, maybe two dumb buddies. A lot of people will do caribou starting out. Caribou are pretty sparse throughout the state, depending on where you go. There's multiple different herds, but there's some land closures and different stuff. A lot of guys go for a blacktail off Kodiak or Prince William Sound. Kodiak, I think, just reduced their bag limit from like $3 for a non-resident down to $1. But you get a sense of the weather, the logistics, like the actual hunting part isn't hard. If you're in a game rich environment, like getting in on a moose, a caribou, even a sheep, I think it's easier than a smart, like 180 inch mule deer, you know, like they're smart, but the weather and the logistics of figuring everything out, how we're going to get everything there, how we're going to stay dry. How do you stay in the game when you have 4 days of a hunt that are just pounding rain? You can't even leave the tent, you know? So probably a Sitka black-tailed deer, maybe Prince William Sound. I wouldn't recommend a black bear, even though you can, but that's kind of a waste of money and shoot those wherever. You can't shoot goat, sheep, or brown bear, or grizzly bear. You need a guide. And you can do moose. It's just the problem with Alaska is everyone wants something for nothing, and they want to come up here like, oh, my budget's $5,000. I'm like, that's not going to get you very far. That's not even like half of the airplane cost just to get you out to shoot the moose and bring it back. Some people are charging $10,000 to $14,000 per person, you know, for a moose hunt. That's do it yourself. That's not a guided thing. So
yeah,
makes a lot of sense to buy your own airplane. And now it makes a lot of sense even more for me to like have my own transportation. But I mean, caribou, I think you can do like $4,000 to $5,000. And then there's some different transporting options, but that's the hard logistical part about Alaska is figuring out how am I going to get to the location? Who's going to take me? And everyone has money and everyone wants to be in the game. And so they're going to have a price point that's enough to meet that demand, and that's a high price point. And so you have to be willing to pay to get in the game.
Gotcha. Do you offer like those services? Is that something like if somebody wanted you to fly them in and out of some place, is that something you offer, or do you kind of keep it mostly to just friends and family type stuff?
Negative. I don't. I've thought about it. It's a whole big ordeal and everything. If I did, I'll just save everyone the hassle of asking me. I just send all the people who ask me to my buddy Kyle. He works at Hunt and Full Adventures. They have the whole outfitter and the do-it-yourself transporting side, and he lives up here in Alaska. He's a good buddy of mine, and he'll line you out on where to go as a booking agent and tell you who's got hunts and openings and kind of what the ins and outs of Alaska are, because I don't know, like, the whole caribou scene or the moose scene on eastern Alaska or up in the Brooks, and they kind of know everything about that, but it's a big business, you know. There's a lot of people involved. There's a lot of money up front and overhead and insurance and pilots and everything. But I mean, that's your ticket to get into the backcountry. There's a few road-based hunts in Anchorage, you know, but there's very minimal roads in Alaska, and that is where people are going to be trying to go and save money. And that's where you're going to, in my opinion, see less animals and more people. And that's not why you're coming to Alaska.
Yeah. A lot of guys will try and do, what is it, the Hall Road or something, where they'll go try to hunt caribou?
Yeah, my brother-in-laws and Tana have done that before, you know, where you drive up there. The problem with the Hall Road is, like, the Alaska pipeline with all the oil coming off the slope is right there on the road. So you have a 5 mile, and that's air miles, not boot miles. 5 miles is the crow flies on each side of the road. That's called the bow zone, where you can only use archery equipment, right? You have to, if you want to kill a caribou with a gun, you have to take off from the road, drop an Onyx pin 5 miles direct from the road, any portion of the road that's close to you, 5 miles from that, get to that, and then begin your hunt. And it's like walking on a waterbed of basketballs. Like, it's the nasty tundra that's like knees to your chest. Yeah. So that sucks. So a lot of people are like flying out in Cubs at a Happy Valley, or they're taking an airboat service from one of the transporters, and they're going up the Iva Shack or different things like that. I don't really know, but that's the hard part of the Hall Road. But yeah, you can fly to Fairbanks. You can rent a U-Haul truck. Tell them you're using it to move. You're not using it to go bow hunting, and drive up the Hall Road and archery hunt caribou. Yeah, you can do that. You're not the only guy. It's busy.
Yeah, I can imagine. Cool, man. Well, is there anything else about Alaska, or like the hunting in Alaska, or the things you do that we want to touch on before we kind of wrap this up here?
Man, I don't think so. It's been fun. Sorry to kind of yak. I'm pretty passionate about it all. And yeah, it's just, you know, a lot of people tell me, man, like, you're just living my dream. And I just tell people, I said, man, this was my dream. Okay. I was the fat kid growing up reading Outdoor Life magazines that my dad had stacked in the back of the crapper. When you see the guys like in hip boots standing on the float of a Super Cub with a moose rack tied to each wind strut, like that was my dream. And it's taken a lot to get here. But like I said, now it's just called Tuesday. So like, I think, not to like get too motivational, but like, you can do it. It takes a lot of effort, and there's a lot of people that would rather just sit there and talk about it, like, oh, someday I'd like to do that. Well, you can't sit there and talk about it. You got to get your ass off the couch and get to work, and then you can actually make it a reality, you know.
For sure, man. Well, that's a good way to wrap things up. One question that I do try to finish everything off with, I don't know if you're a big reader at all or not, but I try to ask every guest for a book recommendation, if you have one for us before we end things here.
Easy. Alaska's Wolfman, Frank Glauser. The guy was a market hunter back when they would, you know, shoot doll sheep to feed mining camps. And like, we had tons and tons of game. He would go out and do this. And he did a lot of wolf control and wolf trapping and wolf studies. And a really, really good book. That's the real deal. It's called Alaska's Wolfman. You can buy it on Kindle or Amazon or whatever, but it's a really good one.
Awesome, man. Well, Adam, before we wrap things up here, tell people how they can find you and get in touch with you and buy a dick bone from you if they want one.
You sick perverts need dick bones. I guess Instagram, my thing is just Grenda89, my last name. And yeah, Stuck in the Rut is the YouTube channel. I think we just hit over 200,000 subscribers. And it's a pretty real deal. We don't do a lot of B-roll or music overlays. It's a lot of just like, hey, we're loading up the airplane and we're in the pickup and we're going to go over here and we try and put a bunch of big animals on the ground and kind of take people along with us. And yeah, it's pretty cool. So I appreciate you having me on, dude. It's been fun.
Definitely. Well, thanks again for coming on, Adam. Any last words before we let you go?
No, man. I appreciate it. Thanks again.
Absolutely. All right, man. I'll talk to you later.
Good.
Bye.
All right, guys. I hope you guys enjoyed that podcast with Adam Grenda. Definitely had a fun time talking with him. But before I let you guys go, make sure you guys check out the podcast on social media. It's Barely_Backcountry_podcast. And then my personal is C.Dillashaw. But that covers it for this week. And I will see you guys on the next one.